I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also be hearing Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to act as the coordinators, net control, interlocutor of this enthusiastic crew that meets here most Sunday evenings on the technical net to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and some of the science and physics that goes along with that. Inside of each real ham radio operator is a kind of a scientist that likes to know, how does this radio stuff really work? How does that antenna radiate that signal? How does that space propagate that signal? How does that transmission line operate on that signal? What does that transmitter and receiver do? How to make them work better? How to test that they're working well? This kind of stuff. During the first hour, we take everyone's call letters who sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. And we try to, on the new technical net, the new improved technical net, do our best to give everyone at least a brief answer during the first hour so that, in the worst case, you don't have to wait more than an hour between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock to get at least a brief answer. At the end of that hour, or near the end of that hour, we flip over to Mel's mailbag, by which the newer people who have discovered ham radio and want to get involved are trying to get their license, and they send questions to Mel. And we do the best to answer those questions, some of them on the air, the more general questions. Mel sometimes gets as many as 300 letters per week, and how he handles all that, I'm not quite sure. That's quite a heroic effort. After the mailbag, if Paul, WS2N, our space enthusiast, happens to have some new information as to what NASA is doing, we hear a report from Paul. At the end of that report, we then go into the deeper questions, and for the rest of the evening, we try to find out what's going on at the molecular level. What is a ferroelectric capacitor? What's really going on with neodymium magnets, and is there free energy to be had? Things along those lines. We get a little bit more esoteric. A person signs into the technical net, as I said before, by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2RFN, Alan, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
And 2EO, Rich, and yes.
My wife. Joe. W2RIY, Joe, yes.
So far we've got Rich and Joe. Anyone else?
KC2UHA, John, yes.
John, give me your call letters phonetically. It sounded like KC2 Uniform Hotel Alpha. Is that what it was, John?
Right on, Dick.
Okay, we got Rich, Joe, and John. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
AB2WC. Name is Ken. Yes.
Okay, we got Alpha Bravo 2 Whiskey Charlie, Ken. And who was the other person who doubled with him?
R-B-C, yes.
And 2MB also.
Okay, we got Barry. Dave, you dropped out a number of times as you gave us your call letters. So give us your call letters a couple of times, Dave.
KC2RPE, Romeo Papa Echo.
Romeo, Papa, Echo. Okay, you were a little bit noisy and a little bit drop-outy there, Dave. Okay, as I said before, Rich, Joe, John, Dave, Barry. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Some guy named Mel. Now, one last call.
KB1, VDB, Lewis with a question.
KB1, Victor, Delta, Delta, Lewis. Do I have that correct, Lewis? Victor, Delta, Delta?
Victor, Delta, Bravo.
Victor, Delta, Bravo. Okay, more than enough. Rich, what's going on in Whitestone? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Hey,
Okay, good evening, Dick, and the TechNet, and 2EO in Whitestone, Queens. Dick, I got some more information for you on that Collins 62S1 transverter. For those not familiar with what a 62S1 is, converts up from 14 megahertz to 6 meters or 2 meters for sideband operation with a KWM2 or an S-line piece of equipment. Dick, after we spoke, I pulled apart the whole 62S1. Let me let it reset. Unfortunately, there's an access plate underneath, but on the transmit deck, but right by the power amplifier, which is a 4X250, there's no access plate, so I had to take the whole thing apart, took the whole transmit deck out. It took me about 2 weeks to service it and get it finished because there were linkages, pulleys, dial cord, all kinds of stuff that had to come out and be put back, and the indexing on the switches and the vary couplers that vary the inductance to track up and down the band all had to be reset. I went through it and realigned it. What I found, Dick, first off, they've got, 8 12-ohm resistors off the cathode to ground, and they bypass them with 1,000-puff capacitors. They do that to read the cathode current through the meter. Those resistors it had increased in value. Let me go to reset. Collins used, I don't know why they did this, they used quarter-watt resistors. So I replaced them with half-watt resistors. I replaced them with 1,000-volt rated 001 ceramic disc bypass capacitors. When I got, also I joke about this, but it's true. I gave it a chemical wash, my famous wash in the dishwasher. For people not familiar, I've done a KWM2, the 62S1. I did a 75S3B receiver in the dishwasher, some other stuff, including a Click 22 AM rig, an Amico TX62. The whole trick is take the tubes out, take the meters out, take the knobs off, take the crystals out. Anything that can come off, meters definitely got to come out. And then let it sit for about 10 days or 2 weeks before you fire it up to make sure it's dry. Anyway, Dick, what's happening now, it's running a lot smoother. The tuning is much smoother. It's drawing the proper amount of current. It's about 800 volts put on the plate, 275 volts on the screen, 200 milliamps of plate current, which... And let it reset. Collins calls for 165 watts input. So 0.2 times 8, that's 160 watts. The efficiency seems a little low. And it's putting out more power, a little more power, on 2 meters than 6 meters, which is, you would think the efficiency would be better on 6. The circuit is this thick. They've got a, off the plate, they've got a 1,000-puff doorknob cap. They go through a coil. The coil goes to ground through a variable inductor to resonate that coil. And then they've got a pickup loop. It's a link-coupled loop that goes off from the output connector. The other end of the loop goes to a variable cap, like a little Johnson cap, and to ground. So I tried playing with the loop. I got the power up a little bit. Maybe it seems a little trite that I'm worried about power, but I'm going to be finishing up this 6-meter kilowatt, which uses a pair of 3500s, and I need all I can get. With a bird meter, I'm getting about 70 watts out on 6, 80 watts out on 2. I wonder if that sounds reasonable to you, Dick. K2RIW and 2EO.
The other person who frequently signs in with quite a bit of Collins experience is Hal. K60PZ, if he's around, we'll ask him about his opinion on this. When it comes to Allen Bradley type carbon composition resistors, I got the speech processor turned on. My voice sounds a little bit muffled tonight. I'm wondering why. The carbon composition resistors in the vicinity of, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms, 10,000 ohms, 30,000 ohms, I think they're reasonably stable. But you take an Allen Bradley resistor that's marked for 5 megohms, or an Allen Bradley carbon composition resistor that's marked for 12 ohms, these extreme values, my experience is that they're not very stable. 5, 10, 15, 20 years downrange, those resistors, particularly if they're running hot in a particular circuit, start degrading pretty fast. Only a quarter watt resistor for the cathode of those tubes, and if the tubes get very slightly gassy, as push-pull output tubes and heat-kit oscilloscopes used to do, and probably these tubes in your 62S1, any slight gassiness in those tubes where they draw a little bit extra cathode current, and therefore increase the dissipation through that cathode bypass resistor, the bypass capacitor and series resistor that develops the bias, makes them run hot and accelerates the rate at which they deviate. So if you happen to have measured those 12-ohm resistors with your ohmmeter, I'd like to know what's the worst-case value you saw. And if you saw numbers like 25 ohms, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, twice the resistance and twice the bias voltage, half the current for the particular tube, and therefore a hell of a lot less gain and improper operation. Yes, it is a little bit mysterious that your 2-meter output is greater than your 6-meter output. But if the 6-meter output is adequate, I wouldn't worry too much. In the case of link coupling, in the case of 2 meters and 432 transmitters, many of the popular designs at the time I was coming out with the parallel kilowatt amplifier, the strip line amplifier that's in April and May 1972 QST, an oldie but goodie, an awful lot of people are using it for EME, I discovered with my experiments that link coupling has got some peculiar characteristics. It's not easy to increase and decrease the loading, as you might have to do because your antenna is changing because of water on the elements or whatever. And the impedance is changing, and therefore you wouldn't readjust what impedance the transmitter is producing in order to give you maximum power output. Link coupling has got this peculiar characteristic where you've got in many cases, a variable capacitor in series with the link output network, and as that link hits resonance, you get maximum power output. And that's somewhere in the middle of the range of the variable capacitor. And as you go to higher or lower capacitor values, you tend to get less coupling. So it's got a peculiar kind of spooky tuning characteristic that doesn't let you know in a clear manner that you're not getting proper loading. If you were studying the screen grid current and the plate current of the tube and detecting whether or not it's in resonance, there's other ways you can figure out that you're not getting proper loading, but it's not easy. And so I fell out of love with link coupling, and therefore I went to capacitive coupling. Everybody was afraid that capacitive coupling would allow lots of harmonics to come through, and within a couple of dB there's very little difference. And as such, capacitive coupling, properly deployed, is a thoroughly monotonic. In other words, as you change the capacitance in a given direction, the loading always keeps increasing or decreasing in that direction. So the link coupling is one of the places where I would worry. Also, when it comes to what power output you're getting, that's really a function of the final tube of your 62S1 and
repeater, timeout, cancel.
By various techniques, you can confirm whether or not the full drive power is getting to the input network of that final tube and whether or not it's got the right screen voltage, cathode bias voltage, and plate voltage. And once you confirm that the right amount of drive power is getting there, and the tube has the right bias voltages on 6 meters, therefore you'll be doubly sure that the tube is capable of giving you full power output on 6 meters, then it's just a matter of the plate circuit hitting the right resonance and the right loading. And so step by step, you can confirm whether or not the drive power on 2 meters versus the drive power on 6 meters getting to that final tube is higher, lower, or the same. So there's a number of ways you can find out what's going on to find that missing 20 watts. I think you said you're getting 80 watts on 2 and 60 watts on 6 meters. And of course, you'd like to get the full 60 watts or full 80 watts or 85 watts on 6 meters. So I think you'll eventually find that out. And as you do, come back and tell us what you find, Rich. I'll turn it back to you, Rich, for any final comments, and drag your feet a little bit in case Hal is there. Maybe he's got some comments on this. N2EO with a possible K60PZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like Hal may not be with us yet. And do tell me, Rich, what's the worst number of ohms that you measured on those 12-ohm cathode resistors that you replaced? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. We have, believe it or not, one, they use pairs, okay? They're 12 ohms, there's four pins for the cathode, 2, 4, 6, 8. That's what they got in there, which is like an ohm total when you plug the tube in and they're all paralleled up. One pair was reading like 70 ohms. I couldn't believe it. It was that high. What I find now is it's tuning much smoother. We discussed the fact that the peak and output power and the dip and plate current were way off. Now they're coinciding very close. Not perfect, but very close. I get max out with minimum plate dip. Everything looks pretty good. I mean, it's 275 volts of on the screen, a little over 800 volts on the plate. The idle current is right because I can monitor the plate current. They call it 70 mils idle. Let me get a reset. And I've got plenty of drive. I mean, I have an abundance of grid current when I hit the transmitter, the KWM2 driving the transverter. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's just shy a little bit, and I'd like to get a little more out of it so I could drive those 3-500s. According to the article that the guy wrote in QST, with 100 watts of drive on 6 meters, SP220 converted to 6, you should get about 1,100 watts out of the thing on sideband. Now, you asked me something else. What I wanted to ask you, Dick, and then we'll go on to the next individual. On that link, can I assume that's a series resonance circuit with the coil, the link in series with the cap, and when you hit resonance, you get maximum current? Is that correct, Dick?
Assuming that the rest of the LC network that's connected to the plate of the tube is hitting resonance correctly, assuming that it's got the right amount of range and doesn't run out of range, under those conditions, the link pickup will give you maximum power output when the inductor of the link and the capacitor of the link hit resonance. But that's not always true. There are ways of taking the input portion connected to the plate of the tube and shifting it a little off to one side and compensating with the link a little bit. So it's not quite straightforward. One other thing is worrying me here, Rich, and that is this is a transverter. There has to be a local oscillator that's mixing your 14 megs or whatever it is for your main drive circuit output up to 6 meters, which is roughly 50 megacycles. So there's a local oscillator involved. Therefore, if you were using simple metering, like a rectifier-type probe on a vacuum 2 voltmeter, or some other kind of metering measuring input power to the final stage, there's a slim possibility that you might be measuring drive power on 6 meters and LO power simultaneously. And therefore, you get a phony reading as to what you think is the full drive power. You may see lots of current change, and you're saying, I'm getting lots of drive, but some of the drive may be local oscillator on the wrong frequency. So if you've got a service monitor that's got a built-in spectrum analyzer or a real spectrum analyzer or another kind of tunable receiver that can tune to the LO frequency as well as the 6-meter frequency, you want to confirm that the drive power getting to the final tube really is on 50.1 megacycles, so to speak, is 95% or more of the drive power getting to the final tube on 6 meters really that frequency.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Really that frequency, 50.1, if that's where you're tuned, and if the LO is, let me pick a number, 25 or 30 dB weaker, then you're in like Flynn. But if you find out that the local oscillator power getting to the final stage is only 6 dB down along with the 50 megacycle component, then just simply measuring with a rectifying network or a power detecting network what you think is the drive power could be wrong. And if you do make that assessment, it'll give you a hint now as to find out why the tuning or the rejection of the LO is not proper. I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Rich. N2AEEO for a final. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, that's a point well taken. It makes a lot of sense. I've been using a Hewlett Packard 427A voltmeter with a Dynascan RF probe to compare oscillator injection on 2 and on 6. They're basically the same. They're using 36 megahertz oscillator mixed with the 14 meg to produce 6 meters. And I forget the exact scheme, but they kick in a 92 megahertz fifth overtone crystal when you jump to 2 meters. I think that'll make sense to you. But, Dick, I own a, I mentioned this before, I own a service monitor. It's a WaveTech 3000B. It doesn't have a, it has a scope in it, but not a, not a service, not a, not a spectrum analyzer, but I, two things I can do with that. First of all, the nice thing about the 3000B over, say, an IFR, you can go into the input. If you transmit into it, it automatically switches to a dummy load. So you're not going to damage the equipment. What I could do is dial up 36 megs and dial up 50 megs. What I'll have to do is get a step attenuator and see how many dB down it is.
You got the right idea there, Rich. By various techniques, you can make a sniffer, a power probe sensing circuit. That's a, in other words, with the drive power connected to the final tube in the normal manner, and you sniff a little bit of the power nearby with the right kind of a probe, by various techniques you'll find out how much 36 megs is there and how much 50 megs is there, and you'd like to know that ratio, because if the ratio is wrong, then the, some of this missing power you're looking for may be discovered. Let us know what you discover on that. That's a We're giving you a homework assignment there to find out the ratios of those frequencies, Rich. Good luck with that experiment. Joe N2RYY was our WA2RYY is our next guy checking in from Great River. And what's going on there with you, Joe? WA2RYY, I hope you got the call letters right. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Of course you got the call letters right, Dick. Good evening. WA2RYY here. I have a propagation question dealing with RF propagation. But before I ask that particular question, I wanted to describe what I was seeing on the air completely. Maybe it'll give you a better picture of what I'm looking at. I was using a spectrum analyzer hooked to my television antenna, which feeds my digital television converter. And I wanted to basically see the image of what I was looking at while I was trying to tune it. I have to go across the broadcast band and notice that on a particular, two particular radio frequencies that are used out of the Sheldon area, that they had digital component type of signatures alongside the main carriers. These digital signals are about 80 kilohertz wide and located 140 kilohertz minus and plus from the center frequencies at about minus 25 dBc. Do you understand that so far?
What I think you're saying is that you're looking for a carrier alongside of this carrier, 125 kc up and 125 kc down. You see these 80 kilohertz wide bands of signals that look like two different chunks of bunch head, so to speak, digital like noise, which appears to be riding on the carrier. And these digital signals with your particular resolution bandwidth, which I know on your service monitor, you can't independently select that like you can on a spectrum analyzer. So depending on how you dial it, it automatically selects a particular resolution bandwidth. But with that particular resolution bandwidth, the digital noise appears to be 25 decibels weaker. And you're wondering, is it something that was really on that carrier, or is it a completely separate signal? And I think Joe and I, by the way, have had a brief conversation on this one this afternoon. And Joe's about to drive around with his automobile and see if that DBC, the ratio of power of those apparent digital sidebands versus the carrier, if one changes versus the other as he drives around. If they really have two independent sources, they will move in amplitude independently. If the real signals that he's seeing as these digital modulation is on that carrier, as he drives around, the composite of all of that will go up and down in magnitude, but it'll obviously act like it's connected, except for some selective fading characteristics. It'll act connected, and therefore he knows he's looking for one source as opposed to two separate sources of signal. I think that's close to what you're discussing, Joe. From E2RYY. Interesting problem. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the Q3s were 160 kilohertz, not 125. Minus 160 and plus 160 from the main carrier. Say, for example, at 106.1, I was seeing the carrier centered at 106.260 and at 105.940, okay? They are coming from the same source because I did do a check with the analyzer in the vehicle and I got a close-up of the transmitter to verify these two sources. These are emitting these signals alongside, which was a little puzzling because I'm not sure how they could occupy more than one radio channel at once, but that's not what the question I'm going to ask. Initially, when I tried to turn the television antenna to try to find the directionality of these digital signals, I actually found that these sidebands, I call them sidebands on each side, would actually drop as much as 50 decibels from the main carrier. And that's what made me think it was not coming from the transmitter site. Can you give me an explanation of why I would see both carriers on both sides of the frequency drop and give me a ratio of almost 45 to 50 decibels minus DBC compared to the main carrier, and then at other times in other directions they would come up and be almost be equal in amplitude when it dropped the main carrier, and these sidebands would apparently be almost as strong as the main carrier. I've never seen this kind of phenomenon happen before. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you do have a real mystery there, Joe. Once again, when you drove around with your vehicle this afternoon with your service monitor being powered from the vehicle as you drove around, I think you're saying you saw evidence that the main carrier and these apparent sidebands all moved in unison. In other words, as you got closer to the source or further from the source, they both got stronger simultaneously. However, at your home with the aimable high directivity antenna, you can make the sidebands on upper and lower both get a hell of a lot of more dBs lower than the carrier just by aiming the antenna. My goodness, that is a mystery. And I think you've already gone through the experiment of plugging in attenuation. One of the next things that's a very friendly thing to do is that if you had a step attenuator that you can place between the antenna and the rest of your electronics in the house, and you start stepping in 3, 6, 10, 15, 20 decibels of attenuation, if every single signal on that display device, the main carrier and the sidebands, let me drop, if they all move decibels for decibels, in other words, you dial in 10 decibels of RF attenuation between the antenna and your electronics, and every single signal you see on that screen moves downward by exactly 10 dB, that's an extremely strong piece of evidence that what you're seeing is most likely real. However, if anything on that screen moves by any other ratio than 10 dB, when you, for instance, plug in a 10 dB attenuator, then you know that some form of nonlinearity is taking place after the step attenuator. This is a beautiful test to be done on a spectrum analyzer. You'd be amazed how many times somebody has got a spectrum analyzer which has a signal, you know, 500 megs away that's not on the screen, but it's there, overloading the front end of the spectrum analyzer, creating all kinds of intermodulation distortion and nonlinearity and saturation and whatever. And then you go downrange, assuming that everything on the screen is real, and some of those signals on the screen are phony, and it can drive you up a wall. By plugging in that 10 dB attenuator, you find out immediately, is anything funny going on? But there's a problem. Let me drop. And that is, the modern-day spectrum analyzers try so darn hard to be idiot-proof that when you demand 10 decibels of extra RF attenuation by the front panel controls, the machine is so hell-bent on making sure that the calibration amplitude at the top of the screen stays the same, that what the darn machine does is it plugs in RF attenuation 10 more dBs, like you asked for, but then it throws in 10 decibels of more gain in the IF strip in order to make the top of the screen have the same DBC reference level. And the fact that two things are changing simultaneously, an increase of gain downrange with a decrease of gain up front, that again can confuse the hell out of you and sometimes mask things. So There's many a spectrum analyzer that won't give you enough menus or whatever from the front panel to get around this effect, and you're forced to use a thoroughly separate step attenuator at the front end to bypass the Don microprocessor inside, which is doing all of this double dipping on you, if you know what I mean, in order to get around the problem. So when you get a chance, Joe, try that attenuator step, if you haven't already done it, to make sure that everything on screen moves dB for dB. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, well, the service monitor I use for this particular test is an IFR 1500, and it's, I would call it sort of like a Cadillac of service monitors in this particular day. It has a front panel control which gives you 0, 20, and 40 decibels of RF attenuation onto the antenna input. It is an actual RF circuit that switches in more resistance and more attenuation, and that's how that works. And when I checked it in 0 dB, I found that nothing across the entire band from 0 to 1,000 meg was higher than minus 35 dBm. Even stuff way out of band like on the parts of the broadcast band and so forth. I am totally aware of what you're talking about some sort of signal way out of band that could overload the front end of the unit. I'm well aware of that. So being that that was not the case of this particular test, it still is very puzzling why I was seeing these sidebands actually dip. The signal coming from the signal is actually coming from the Selden area, up on Adirondack Drive, at least one or two of these transmitters. And that's a bearing of about 030 degrees from my home QTH. And I got a dip in the end of these two sidebands at, say, about 225 degrees and about 295 degrees, somewhere around those two figures. I noticed they were pretty severe, whereas the main carrier did not dip as much. But one point on the compass, I got the actual fundamental carrier to dip almost the same level as the two sideband signals. So this is why this whole thing is puzzling to me. I've never seen RF do this kind of thing. And it just made me think possibly part of the answer might be they might be putting out some different polarization on these two different signals. I don't know if that's a possibility or not, where the main carrier might be horizontally and vertically polarized, and these two sidebands might be just horizontally polarized. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. You just hit a very good hypothesis there, Joe. Fantastic. If, for instance, the sidebands were vertically polarized and the main carrier was horizontally polarized, and there are kinds of FAA signals that absolutely do that for very good reasons, if that was really going on, then as you swish the antenna, your high-gain antenna, and you swish it in azimuth, you're seeing what's called the Condon lobe, C-O-N-D-O-N, a man who way back in World War II discovered that if you put co-polarized energy into an antenna, let's assume I've got a horizontally polarized antenna, and I look at a horizontally polarized signal, I get a very characteristic antenna pattern. Main lobe, side lobes that are 13 dB down for the first ones, and 17 dB down for the second side lobes, and so on. You get a very characteristic pattern as you swish that antenna in azimuth, whether the signal is coming from the north, the east, the south, the west, or whatever. However, if you've got a horizontally polarized Yagi looking at vertically polarized signals, the peaks and valleys in the antenna pattern is an entirely brand new pattern. It's got peaks and valleys in some funny, very funny places. Guys who use a horizontally polarized 2-meter Yagi, let me drop. Use a horizontally polarized Yagi to listen to a vertically polarized 2-meter repeater station, and you get some, and you try to peek up on the station, you make it the strongest signal to the repeater. When you aim the antenna 30 degrees to the right or 30 degrees to the left, and you aim it right at boresight, and the signal you want to get there is a 10 dB weaker, if you know what I mean. That's the Condon lobe effect, the cross-polarized effect. And so, can a transmitter put out different polarizations for different frequencies that are associated? Absolutely. Takes a little bit of elaborate hardware to do that, usually two separate antennas, but yes, it can definitely, or two different feed points at least to the same antenna. So I think you've got an extremely good hypothesis there, Joe. As you drove around with your vehicle, because your vehicle had a more omnidirectional antenna, and as you aim the vehicle to various directions, the polarization of the antenna changes slightly. The cross-polarization effects change slightly, but still, as you went up to Adirondack Drive, which I think is where the source probably was located, I presume, in general, side lobes and main carrier tended to increase at about the same rate as you got close. Is that approximately true, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW in the deck net?
That is absolutely correct. The consistent average I saw was the two side bins, digital side bins, were about minus 25 dBC. Now that brings up, I guess, another question you could ask your broadcast expert on here, is how are FM stations allowed to do this? We're occupying half of the next radio channel on each side of their normally assigned frequency.
They're probably not allowed to do that without a special special temporary authority. An STA license would be required, and even that would only be granted if those two adjacent channels are in this area thoroughly blank. If there's really broadcast stations assigned to those adjacent channels, they would never get that permission. So that's one, it's one possibility. They were given a special temporary authority to do this experimental transmission for a second audio program or stereo or whatever. That's a possibility number one. Possibility number two is there is an unintentional radiation coming out of that transmitter, and maybe you're discovering it. That's another possibility. So eventually you're going to pin down the exact station that's doing it and what licensing they've got, and once you find out which station is doing it and you look at the FCC records as to what the special temporary authorities they may have been granted, I think you've got a very interesting investigation going on here, Joe. Have you gotten close enough to the station where you stand the possibility of pinning down who is the licensee? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Oh, sure. I know that the two stations are operating, they've been operating on these frequencies for a long amount of time. I've never seen these digital sidebands carries come up before, but I've never really intentionally looked for them either. I was really looking for outside interference to start with. One of them is WBLI on 106.1, the other one is WALK on 97.5. They both had the same kind of composite digital sidebands that were about minus 25 dBC from the carrier, and about the same frequency separation and about the same width. So it looks like it's an intentional emission out of these transmitters.
Yeah, with all this digital audio and digital video going on these days, that could be intentional. So as you dig deeper into the ALK and BLI licensing, you may discover that they've been given authority to radiate these funny signals. So when it comes to how many dB down and how many kilohertz away, are both of those stations transmitting what looks like the identical signal? Is that what you are seeing so far, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, both digital carriers were about approximately 80 kilohertz in width, with the center frequency being centered plus and minus about 160 kilohertz from the center assigned frequency at minus 25 dBC.
And just to be double sure now, there's a slim possibility this is intentional. The adjacent channel above and below each of these stations in this area, are those blank channels to your knowledge? Joe, go ahead.
Yes, they seem to be, because I rotated the antenna from 0 to 360, and I could not see any other carriers, FM carriers, pop up on these frequencies, on these sideband frequencies, because I guess the nearest frequency would be, in the case of 106.1, would be 106.3 and 105.9, as far as center frequency. I saw nothing else come up that I could visually see on the analyzer, and that's pretty much it. And by the way, my service monitor, I can transfer power into, with reference to what the last person talked about with service monitors. So Mike could do that, as well as use the spectrum analyzer and receiver at the same time.
If only one of these stations was doing it, I would now be saying that either they've been given temporary authority or it's an unintentional transmission. But now that you found two separate stations, both transmitting a very identical-looking set of digital sidebands, I'm beginning to think it's real. Unless they both have the exact same brand name of transmitter and they both got this unintentional modulation on there. But again, to be cross-polarized, you'd have to be intentionally doing that. To end up with an unintentional signal going to the conventional antenna and have polarization for the unintentional signal being different than the intentional signal, that would be a very difficult thing to happen by accident. doesn't begin to sound like it's happening by design. And as you dig deeper, that's my vote right now. You're going to discover that this is some form of other information being put on the carrier, and quite possibly they're doing it with permission. So keep us informed as you continue this investigation. Sounds like some good work there, Joe. If anybody knows the need for a radio service person, Joe's the man you're looking for. He'd like to find a job at this time if anybody knows of one, so please suggest it to Joe if you know of one. Next person who signed in was John, KC2 Uniform Hotel Alpha. What would you like to talk about tonight, John? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes, good evening, Dick. KC2UHA, John here in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And my question is this. In the past, I was listening to the TechNet, and you described directional couplers. So I got a little interested in that. I did a little research, and I came across something similar, a hybrid coupler, to be more specific, a quadrature hybrid coupler. Now, my question is really simple. I'm relatively new to amateur radio, but not necessarily new as a tech. Let me drop it. So my question is this. Can I use a quadrature hybrid coupler as a TR switch? That's number one. And the other thing is, if the two ports are 90 degrees apart, can I take one and feed it into a dipole vertically and take the 90 degree and feed it to a dipole horizontally, thereby making a circular polarized antenna? Is that possible, or did I misinterpret the whole thing and I got it all wrong? This is KC2UHA, back to K2RIW.
What you own there, Dave, is a beautiful piece of hardware. A quadrature hybrid, better known as a 3-decibel directional coupler, as well as quadrature hybrid. It's got about 3 or 4 different names. Power divider, power summer. When you take those two ports, which with good design, they are exactly 90 degrees apart at the center design frequency, and depending on how good the design is, sometimes they can stay 90 degrees apart across the 500 megacycles. You take, for instance, the Zinger quadrature coupler made by the Anorin company. There's one of those that I've used that's rated for 500 to 1,000 megacycles, and across that 500 megacycle region, it stays 90 degrees difference between those two output ports, plus or minus a couple of degrees. Beautiful device. And you put one of those to the horizontal dipole and one of them to the vertical dipole, and those dipoles are, so to speak, aimed to the north. You will make a beautiful circular polarized signal to the north. That's a very good Cadillac approach to making circular polarization. And as you swish in frequency, it'll stay very close to circular. And a good quadrature hybrid, let me drop, really has 4 ports to it. Quite often, one of those ports has a built-in 50-ohm termination. But if it doesn't, if you are supplying the 4th port with an external 50-ohm termination, you can therefore switch between the normal input port and the 50-ohm termination is used in the normal way, and then reverse the two, feed your signal into the 50-ohm termination port, and terminate the other port. When you do that, you will be switching your antenna from clockwise circular polarization to counterclockwise circular polarization, and you're doing that electronically without rewiring the antennas. Ain't that beautiful? A quadrature hybrid that doesn't have a built-in 50-ohm termination gives you that ability. And even if it's got a 50-ohm internal termination, there's ways you can rewire it to bring that out as the 4th port. So that's a definite yes on that one. Now, can you take a quadrature hybrid and make an electronic transmit-receive switch out of it? I think the answer is yes, but it's not simple. When you feed input power to one of the normal input ports, it is always putting power out of the two output ports, one of them at 0 degrees and one of them at 90 degrees relative to each other. And so to make that into a electronic switch for transmit and receive, well, in the case of the clockwise counterclockwise that I just described, let me drop. The California guys on microwave in the late 50s built things that they called polar plexer, where they would transmit clockwise and receive counterclockwise. And because you're quadrature hybrid, if all four ports are available to you, one of the ports becomes transmit clockwise, and the other one becomes potentially transmit counterclockwise or receive counterclockwise. So with polar plexing, with careful tuning, it is possible to transmit and receive simultaneously, transmit clockwise into port number one, while you're receiving counterclockwise in port number two. With a little bit of careful tuning, you can make the isolation between those two ports 30, 40, 50 dB, and therefore your receiver will not be desensitized by your own transmitter. So the California guys in the late 50s and early 60s were doing this polar plexing with something like the quadrature hybrid you're describing, and therefore you and the guy you're talking to are using a full duplex circuit, like a telephone, an ordinary wired telephone, if you know what I mean, where you're transmitting and receiving simultaneously on the exact same frequency, without the normal 600 KC of offset on this repeater, if you know what I mean. So properly used, you got a fun toy there, John. KC2, Uniform Hotel Alpha. Good thing to study. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, UHA. Thank you for that, Dick. Also, you mentioned the California microwave guys. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because that sounds very interesting, and I would like to get into that a little bit more. Is that possible? Back to you.
No, it's not possible, John. You got to live in California to do this. That's a joke. The guys on Marine Avenue in Brooklyn, they're allowed to do this. They're given special permission, John. Yeah, I'm talking about the San Bernardino Microwave Society. San Bernardino Microwave Society is the center of this activity that was going on in the late 50s, early 60s, and probably even in the 70s. All of a sudden, I can't think of the call letters of the main spokesman there. My mind's going blank. But you start looking up the San Bernardino Microwave Society, of which I was a member for quite a number of years, visited them and attended a number of their meetings, a real good group. You've also got the San Diego group, and you've got the San Francisco group. So the biggest groups in California that are doing serious microwave work, number one is San Bernardino Microwave Society. Number two is the so-called San Diego Microwave Group. And number three, there's a smaller group in the San Francisco area. But San Bernardino Microwave Society, you Google those words and you Google the word polar plexer. I bet you're going to find 15 articles, a little bit on the old side, but they're going to tell you how they did it, how they set up very simple coffee can type feed horn for their antennas that were doing this polar plexing operation. And so if you could gather a small group of guys in Brooklyn that have the progressive attitude where they're willing to do some serious microwave work with simple equipment and a little bit of crafty techniques, this polar plexing should be really be a lot of fun. Back to you for any fills on that, John. KC2UAHA. You don't have to wait for the drop of the repeater. Just wait for the beeps and then start talking to me. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Thank you for that, Dick. Polar plexer. Okay, I got that written down, and I will check out the California guys. And yes, I am interested in that because, I'm stuck in an apartment. I can't put up big antennas, so I got to think small. And I don't have a lot of money, so like you say, I got to think crafty. So anything that I can run across that will help me with my hobby is well appreciated. So I thank you, and back to the net.
Yeah, let us know, John, as you do that research, whether it's successful or unsuccessful. And if you can find a micro, if you can become the nucleus of a microwave group in Brooklyn, you'll be doing something really good. My good buddy in the Perth Amboy area of New Jersey used to call himself the KGB, the Climbing Gigahertz Brethren. KGB was his funny way of calling it. That was Ed, and he's not as active these days, but he was the 10 gigahertz group, and those guys were, you know, building antennas that are only an inch wide and doing some really good work. But that group, because of Ed being inactive these days, has not been doing as much work, and it's about time somebody resurrect that in Brooklyn. Good luck with that project. Come back and keep us informed as it goes. Dave was next. KC2, I think it's Romeo Papa Echo. Go right ahead, Dave. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening. I have something a little bit more basic tonight. I'm trying to wrap my head around the difference between the CTCSS continuous tone coded squelch system versus the digital code squelch that we have on these radios. And I don't know if any folks even use them, but can I get a definition and maybe to help me out on understanding that? Thanks.
Yeah, I only know about one of them, and I'm hoping somebody within the sound of my voice can give us some information on the other one. This repeater, for instance, will only repeat a signal that has a slightly sub-audio tone at 136.5 hertz. That's the digital coded squelch. Is that digital? That's the tone squelch required for you, this one. Also, there's a series of tones that are used with a touch tone telephone, where each time you press one of the buttons, two separate tones are transmitted simultaneously, and those two separate tones under each one of the 10 buttons, 0 through 9, have very carefully selected frequencies so that the harmonics of one don't fall into the harmonics of the other, and there's no ambiguity if there's any non-linearity in the system. So the tones that are used for touch tone telephone are very carefully chosen to get around that problem. This particular repeater, though, needs 136.5 hertz. Anyone with the sound of my voice want to give us their words on how digital coded squelch works? K2RIW in the TechNet. Huh. There's got to be somebody out there that knows what is digital coded squelch. In fact, my Kenwood TS711A that you're listening to right now has a button on the front panel. I'm afraid to press it, but it does say DCS on it, and DSQ. I believe there are kinds of transmissions where a burst of digital information is created on each transmission to make sure that only the right people listen to that particular signal. That's what I think one of the digital coded squelches are. There's got to be somebody out there to give me a lot more information than what I know about this one. Please give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2EO.
Go right ahead, Rich. Tell us whatever you know, because I don't know much.
I got some audio coming through here. I hope it's not bothering anything. I may get some talk back through the mic. What it does, it's like PL, except it's a digital code, just that. It keeps sending and repeating and repeating and repeating. And as long as that code is there, the repeater will stay open. They use Motorola numbers. I don't know how the numbering system relates to frequency or... they use like 0065, 071, 074, 073. These are different Motorola nomenclatures for the DCS. And some repeaters are starting to use them. Very few, though, Dick.
WHYY.
Okay. Yeah, my first question is going to be, if there was a burst of digital information at the beginning of a transmission, which says that, yes, this is the right person to be going through this repeater, and please let him go through, I would understand that. If the digital coded squelch is being sent simultaneously with the voice, then How do you stop that from interfering with the voice? Let's see what Joe's got to say on this one. W2RYY, K2RYW. You got it, Joe.
Digital coded squelch is a type of modulation which directly modulates an FM type of transmitter. You can't use it on phase modulated transmitters because the transmitter has to have a resolution down to 1 hertz. Rich is right, it's a repeating type of code, and it takes a little longer for the DPL to lock up in a receiver than it does with PL. Typically 150 milliseconds, so lockup time, maybe a little less. There are 84 DPL codes. I think that's standard because you can take 42 of the codes and invert them. So it can be normal or inverted, where there are 32 standard PL tones. Back to you, Dick.
But the digital coded squelch itself, with these 84 or whatever it is codes and the inversions of them, is it ultrasonic or is it sub-audio? How does it stop from interfering with the voice? In other words, if I was doing a digital coded squelch transmission simultaneous with my voice, would my voice become interrupted periodically and the burst of code come through? Or is the code sub-audio or is the code ultrasonic so that it can be simultaneous with my voice without creating distortion with my voice? How does the voice come through in the presence of the code? Over to you, Joe.
The code is sent in the subaudible range. As I said, your transmitter that you use this on has to have a response down to 1 hertz. Typically, these things are around 30 or 40 hertz or something like that. I don't think you can really even detect the audio much above 70 hertz. That's about the frequency range. Call up, say, 1 hertz to 70 hertz, approximately. If you looked at it with a service monitor, you'd see like a repeating type of waveform that looks like a sine wave that's cut off from the top and bottom.
Okay. Is this a Motorola invention, and how long has this existed? How many pieces of ham equipment have it? For instance, does my Kenwood TS-711, which is a 1980s piece of equipment, does it really have that function built into it, or am I looking at another function here? Over to you, Joe.
Well, DPL is the actual Motorola identification of what they call it. The DCS is the industry standard type of designator for it. DPL has been around for about 30, 35 years at least. They started putting that in the Motorola equipment about in the, I think, the mid-70s approximately. They started coming out with DPL early to mid-70s because they realized in commercial service that they were using up the PL tones way, way too fast as far as systems that had a community repeater where you had up to 16 users or more on a particular frequency or from multiple sites. So they were running through PL tones very, very quickly. And to prevent code tone interference, they had to come out with another system where they basically gave you a lot more flexibility with the tone codes. And with the radio you have, early Jap radios, typically what they did when you pushed it to DCS, they made the thing go into encode and decode at the same time. So if you push that, what you may have happen is you may just cut off your receive audio because it doesn't have the right code coming in to open up your receiver, even though you are transmitting DPL or DCS, as it's called. You can check that at any time. You can push your radio, put the button into DCS, you'll probably hear the repeater go away.
NY2H.
Okay. Lou, please tell us what you know about it. And I know one of the questions that Dave's going to ask is, do you know of articles that Dave can go to where he can read more about this? NY2H, K2RW. You got it, Lou.
Good evening, all. Just a couple of sentences from Wikipedia. And it says, DCS, digital coded squelch, superimposes a continuous stream of FSK digital data at 134.4 bits per second on the transmitted signal. The same way that a single CTCSS tone would be used on an entire group of radios, the same DCS code is used in a group of radios. Now, it's referred to digital private line, like Joe said, trademark of Motorola. Likewise, GE calls it digital channel guard, or DCG. And ICOM calls it digital tone code squelch. There are 23-bit words that are used, and for most of them, there are actually three different valid codes. In other words, because of the way it's synced up, from what I understand, is if you took the inverse of the bits. I think you would also get, you know, they have, I think it's a plus and a minus setting, and it goes into some of that. I think a couple of the words actually